Let's begin this attempt at constructing a messianic profile of the king, Psalm 21, by examining the heart of this king. You'll note first in 21 that the king is described by his heart for Jehovah. Verse 1 says, "The king shall joy in thy strength." Verse 1 also says, "In thy salvation, how greatly shall he rejoice." Skipping over to verse 7 now, it says, "For the king trusteth in the Lord." Also in verse 7, "Through the mercy of the Most High, he shall not be moved." This messianic profile, this is the heart the king has for Jehovah. Note second, the description then of how of Jehovah's heart for the king. Verse 2, "Thou hast given him his heart's desire." Verse 2, "Hast not withholden the request of his lips." Verse 3, "Thou preventest him with the blessings of goodness." Verse 3, "Thou settest a crown of pure gold on his head." Verse 4, "He asked life of thee, and thou gavest it him, even length of days forever and ever." Verse 5, "His glory is great in thy salvation." Verse 5, "Honor and majesty hast thou laid upon him." Verse 6, "Thou hast made him most blessed forever." Verse 6, "Thou hast made him exceeding glad with thy countenance." These then are showing us Jehovah's heart for the king. The importance seems to be given to how Jehovah sees the king, and the king sees Jehovah, not on the king's political or strategic cunning, not on wealth or family position, not on popularity or entitlement, any of that, simply on the relationship one to another. Father to son, son to father. Note, not only do we see the wonderful love of the Father in these descriptions, we also see further evidences of the king's heart for the Father, in that he was desiring from the heart, he was requesting from his lips, he was asking life of thee, he was glorifying in the Father's plan of salvation, and in his obedient part in that. And he was glad in thy countenance. There's no mention of Messiah's military or political might. Simply, verse 1, "The king shall joy in thy strength, O Lord." This is important to note because there are many people that are waiting to see this political or military might only. They think that they will know Messiah when he comes with this irresistible strength, military or political. Now, this is not to mean that at some point Messiah doesn't come in tremendous military or political might. It means that his political or military might is not essentially what makes him king. No, his relationship to Jehovah, first and foremost, makes him this kind of king. And this is exactly as it should be. This is what separates this king from all the other mighty kings of earth that have ever ruled over mankind with an iron fist. There's a part in our human mindset that is only respectful of the perception of power. We are under the perception, for instance, that our law enforcement officials have the power to keep us from riotous violence and savage plunder. We are under the perception that our justice system will be blind to preference and bribery. We are under the perception that our government will protect us from hostile enemies within and without, wisely spend our tax revenues, promote fair commerce, serve the public's best interest, and keep itself from corruption. All of this trust is based upon the perception that these state and federal entities have the power to accomplish exactly this. Perception, I say, because what power do these entities actually have other than our perception? Not only do we allow ourselves to be governed by these perceptions of power, nearly every nation of peoples on earth presumes to have the power of God standing behind it. This presumption is no greater in the United States than it is in Iran, or in Israel as it is in Jordan, or in Great Britain than it is in Japan. Perceptions and presumptions are dangerous things to be basing our trust and governances upon. But when it comes to Christ, as fulfilled by Jesus of Nazareth, we have yet to see such an overwhelming perception of presumption of power. All we really see here is him depending entirely upon Jehovah's strength, both for himself and for us, and his rejoicing in Jehovah's salvation. How are we then to make logical comparisons of these matters of power and might? Perhaps we cannot yet make such comparisons. Are we to conclude from this then that Jesus is not Christ? Or should we rather conclude that we hold false perceptions and expectations and presumptions of power and might? There's no mention of Messiah's popularity or public support. Verse 7, about all we can see here is, for the king trusteth in the Lord being Jehovah. And through the mercy of the Most High, he shall not be moved. That's about all we see as far as popularity and public support. There's but one person's acceptance and favor that this Messiah King seeks, Jehovah's. This also is exactly as it should be. This is what separates this king from all other popular, influential figures on earth that have governed over mankind with a majority or consensus vote. Just ahead of King David's time, King Saul was a very popular man, a very handsome and rugged aristocrat who stood head and shoulders above the other likely candidates. And you will recall that it was the nation that wanted a king now to rule over them instead of God in the first place. The other nations had kings. Why not then Israel? Jehovah was not for this change, but allowed it. The first king out of the chute was the very popular Saul. Saul's heart and God's heart seldom crossed paths from the very beginning, and their relationship went downhill from there, from that time on. However, Saul was still popular, especially among his native Benjamites, even decades after his horrible demise. Are we to think that public popularity and consensus have any substantial meaning to Jehovah? Popularity has often been plagued, historically, by our doing too much, or our doing too little, too late, too early, or our doing the wrong thing for the wrong reason, to the wrong persons, to the wrong extent, yet all the time feeling quite certain of ourselves. Is this what Jehovah's plan for our salvation is to come down to? Popular vote? I certainly hope not. So when we look upon this Christ as fulfilled by Jesus of Nazareth, We can certainly say that not even his own Jewish people believed in him. He certainly did not fulfill their expectations of restoring Israel back to sovereign prominence. In fact, to this day, he remains the most despised and rejected figures of their illustrious past. No, all we see is him trusting in Jehovah's mercy that he not be moved. How are we to make a logical comparison of these matters of popularity and consensus? Perhaps we cannot yet make such comparisons. Are we to conclude then from this that Jesus is not the Christ? Or that perhaps we hold a false perception and expectation of popularity and public consensus? You see, the most important part of this messianic king profile is not what the king is doing. It is what Jehovah is doing to and doing for the Messiah. Notice the language here, that thou hast given him. The language, hast not withholden. The language, thou preventest him or protect him is another way of reading that. Thou settest, thou gavest, thou hast made him. Through the mercy of the Most High, he shall not be moved. This is the language. If that is the way the psalmist has written this profile, then this is the way that we have to receive and understand this profile. Why should we be watching for Messiah to appear having his own strength, or appearing rejoicing to be able to save himself by his own hand, or trusting in his own worth and resource, keeping him from being moved rather than Jehovah's mercy? Why should he be requesting Jehovah's protection? Why should he be asking for his life back and length of days forever? Why should he be waiting for Jehovah's crown and pure gold and not assertively going out and grabbing his own, either by might or popularity? I think that the answer is becoming plain to see. Answer is a radical departure from what we ourselves rationalize and imagine to expect. The answer is both radical and yet beautiful in its simplicity. Let's listen to Paul, the way Paul put this simplicity. As he was writing to his readers in Corinth, in 1 Corinthians, an epistle he wrote to them, chapter 1, we'll begin in verse 22 and read through verse 24. Paul writes of this simplicity, saying that the Jews require a sign. They require something, you know, show us this force, show us this authority, show us this prominence that Israel's supposed to be brought back to. Show it. They're requiring a sign. And the Greeks seek after wisdom. You know, philosophy and humanism and secularism and thisism and thatism, all these many isms, wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness, but unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. That's the radical simplicity that this profile is suggesting.